This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Lolly Focus Pops or Lolly Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the Language on the Move podcast, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Ingrid Piller, and I'm Distinguished Professor of Applied Linguistics at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia. My guest today is Dr. James McIlvenny. James, is that how you pronounce your name?
Yeah, that is how I pronounce my name. But I actually do like to encourage variant pronunciations, because I think that it'll give philologists something to do after I die.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, so we'll try another pronunciation like McIlvenny.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Dr. McIlvenny, or James, let's just do it like that. James is a linguist and an intellectual historian at the University of Siegen in Germany. He is the author of A History of Modern Linguistics, and also of Language and Meaning in the Age of Modernism. He also hosts the History and Philosophy of the Language Sciences podcast. Today, we're going to talk about his new book, A History of Modern Linguistics, which has just come out from Edinburgh University Press. Welcome to the show, James.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on.
James, can you start us off by telling us how you got to write A History of Modern Linguistics? Aren't there enough histories of linguistics already?
There are plenty of histories of linguistics. So what happened is I was doing a postdoc at the University of Edinburgh, and I was teaching their course in the history of linguistics while I was there. And the linguistics editor at Edinburgh University Press came to me. I'd already published my first book with them. And the linguistics editor at Edinburgh University Press came to me and said that they'd like a textbook in the history of linguistics for their linguistics series. And so I thought, gee, that should be relatively easy. I can just base it on the course I've been teaching. And I also long had the ambition of doing a podcast. So I thought that I might be able to imitate Peter Adamson, who does the podcast A History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps. And he's produced books with Oxford University Press based on that podcast. So I thought, I could just turn my lectures into a podcast, and then I could turn the podcast into a book. It didn't turn out to be quite as simple as that. So moving from, one text type to another, in my experience, was actually quite complicated. So podcasts have their own format and affordances, which I had to adapt my lectures to. And then turning that into a book was also a huge amount of work to make it into a, coherent written text. But it's done now, so.
It's eminently readable. I really enjoyed reading the book so much. And I think the process you've just described of trying out the text with your students and then turning it into a podcast and then turning it into a book really shows in the readability of the book. So I enjoyed that immensely.
I'm glad you think so.
So tell us, how did you actually choose where to begin and where to end? Because it's not a history of the langue de Re from the Greek and Sanskrit grammarians to, you know, the present day. It's actually a much narrower project. So can you tell us about the beginning and the end? And
yeah. Why? So it's meant to be a history specifically of disciplinary linguistics. And by that, I mean this modern discipline of linguistics that we study at universities. So I think that there's a great deal of value in a, you know, in a longue durée history of linguistics, which is the mode that most histories that have previously been published are written in, you know, where they go back to ancient Greece and follow things through the medieval period and the early modern period right up to the modern era. That's very good, but it's more of a sort of old-fashioned history of ideas kind of approach. And I think there are some problems with that. Like, it sort of is based on the assumption that there's a fact, or that there are facts about the nature of language, and that we have discovered them, and that it's a story of simple progress, of us, you know, building on what has happened in the past. And I mean, of course, we do know a lot of things about language that, you know, that are the direct result of the research that we do today at universities. But we've also forgotten a lot of what has come before. And we also have a very, as university researchers in linguistics departments, we also have a very specific perspective on language. There is much, much more that could be said. So I think that it can be problematic to assimilate everything that has come before to, you know, to say that is all like a prelude to what we do now. And that all of those things that have come before need to be understood on their own terms. Each of those needs its own book, and they have their own books. So I thought I will start, you know, when this modern discipline starts. And I don't say that nothing came before. I do actually refer back to things that came before when they're relevant to what is happening in the modern discipline. But place a boundary there and say, this is when the modern discipline starts. And I say that it's sort of around the beginning of the 19th century when modern research universities came into being. So the first of those being the University of Berlin, and linguistics as a modern university discipline started to develop. As for the end point, well, that has its own story as well. I actually wanted to come much closer to the present, but I also wanted to get the book finished before my funding ran out. This is, you know, one of the contingencies of being a researcher in modern linguistics. So I decided to end it with World War II, where there's a major shift that the sort of center of gravity of linguistics as a discipline and of lots of other university disciplines shifted from Europe to America. And there's the beginnings of that shift in the book. So I talk about figures like Bloomfield and Sapir, and then the, you know, the so-called American structuralists. But I don't venture into the sort of Cold War period when America became preeminent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and look, I think that makes a whole lot of sense, even if it was sort of an extraneous reason. So you just started that stated that essentially the book starts with the foundation of the modern research university in Germany and Berlin University. I'd still like to go one little step before that, because your book actually starts with Sir William Jones and the discovery, if you will, of Indo-European language family. And so can you tell us a bit about Sir William Jones and why you started there and what was novel about his work?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's easy to overemphasize the role of Sir William Jones. So this is the traditional fable of how modern linguistics came into being. So I repeat it in the book, but I mark it as the traditional fable. You know, so I mentioned that as soon as linguistics started to form as a discipline, people started writing histories of linguistics, and this story started to develop that there was, you know, Sir William Jones and then Schlegel and then Bopp and Grimm. And so I repeat it, like I rehearse this story so that, you know, because this is designed for as an introduction to the history of linguistics, so that people are aware that this is the traditional narrative. But at the same time, I try to, you know, poke holes in it. You know, so William Jones is well known because he was a British judge in Calcutta and was very interested in philology. You know, in fact, he probably went to India to pursue his philological interests. And he studied Sanskrit, and he gave a famous address where he pointed out the similarities between Sanskrit and ancient Greek and Latin, and said that this must mean that they came from a common ancestor. And then this has sort of been taken as the beginning of historical comparative linguistics. But there are, if you actually read Sir William Jones's address, you immediately see that this is not modern linguistics as we understand it. The framework that he's putting this genealogical narrative into is actually a biblical framework. You know, he's talking about the sons of Noah, you know, spreading across the earth, and that's how he identifies, you know, the families of languages in the world today. So it's a sort of medieval hangover.
Yeah, I really like that idea of the medieval hangover, as you put it, and that still we have medieval ideas baked into modern linguistics. So let's then go from William Jones to the German foundations of modern linguistics, because essentially you are telling a story of two national, or of a national discipline that's grounded in two nations, if you will, the beginnings in Germany in the 19th century, and then the passing of the baton, if you will, to the United States in the 20th century. So why Germany? What was going on in Germany at the time that, you know, provided this fertile ground for the creation of this new discipline?
Well, I mean, above all, it's the creation of the research university, you know, which is in no small part an achievement of Humboldt, of Wilhelm von Humboldt, who was himself very interested in language and made sure that professorships in language were represented in the new research university in Berlin, and brought Bopp to Berlin to pursue his comparative approach to grammar. But there's also a broader social and political context, which comes out very clearly, you know, in the story of Grimm, of German nationalism, of trying to find, first of all, or on one level, trying to show that people who speak German are a unified national group. And this is before the days of Germany as a political unity. So it was a project to try and raise German national consciousness as a way of forging a political unity, and also to create a history for the German nation, because, you know, the great rivals of the Germans at this time, the French, you know, could trace their own intellectual history back to classical Rome, back to the ancient world, whereas the Germans had nothing. They just had barbarians as their ancestors. But through historical comparative linguistics, you can show that that the Germans actually belong to this bigger Indo-European family, you know, that links them up with Sanskrit, an even older and more prestigious tradition, as was understood in 19th century Europe.
Yeah, that's amazing. And so can you maybe talk us through about some of the key linguistic ideas about what's new in language now? So if we start with, I mean, you've mentioned Bopp and Grimm. What's key for Bopp and Grimm, and then maybe the neo-grammarians?
Okay. What's key? Well, the key methodological breakthroughs that they made, you know, so Bopp went through the meticulous he undertook the task of comparing in, you know, excruciating detail the conjugational forms across the European languages, and thereby provided a basis for reconstructing, you know, the ancestor that they could have come from. So instead of talking in sort of general terms about similarity, you could actually show in detail how forms, what the ancestral forms would have looked like. And then Grimm is usually credited, you know, with establishing the principle of sound laws. So showing how specific sounds have changed historically over time.
And I guess that this methodological innovation really was new in a sense, and was not necessarily well received by all the key players at the time. I mean, many people sort of thought that, you know, Bob in particular was really pedantic, and you cite this nice little limerick of sorts about
how
he's really a pedant. And so what's the tradition against which linguistics establish itself as this very formal and very narrow discipline?
Yeah. So, I mean, these grammatical tasks, these details of grammar that people like Bopp were interested in, you know, that form the basis of comparative grammar, were traditionally considered just to be something that you had to know about in order to be able to read texts in an ancient language. And that the real task was understanding the culture and the literature that is written in these ancient languages, and not to obsess about the grammatical forms. But Bopp, you know, for the first time, or Bopp, you know, spearheaded this tradition where grammar becomes the really important thing. You can make your entire career just out of comparing forms, and the literature, what is actually written in the language, is completely irrelevant or is of secondary importance. Yeah. And I think that this is probably, it's probably fair to say that this is something that characterizes linguistics as a discipline, that it is becoming, or that linguistics as a discipline has this sort of fetishization of form, by which I mean that, you know, linguists want something that their discipline is about. They want an object that they study that is different from what everyone else has. So the traditional philologists, they have literature, they have culture, and so on. But the linguists have the language in itself. They have the grammar. They have the forms. So it's all about separating the form off. And this is what Bopp has done, you know, and then with the neo-grammarians who you mentioned, you know, they turn this into an art that the, you know, the laws, the sound laws of how languages change become the key thing. That's what it's all about. And then even if you move into the structuralist era, you could understand Saussure's distinction between la langue and la parole as being, you know, a further manifestation of this desire to hive off language as a special thing that linguists study themselves. Mm-hmm. So la langue is the formal system of the language, you know,
yeah,
idealized.
It's an imagined system,
it's
right?
An imagined,
I mean,
system.
He claims it or posits this exists, and parole is not interesting, but really.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is controversial whether Saussure thought that there could never be any, whether Saussure thought that parole was not interesting at all as a scientific object, but definitely he is usually understood as saying that la langue is where all the action is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So your book covers, you know, this 200 years of intellectual history. There are 15 chapters, and we don't really have time to go into all of them, but I think told us very nicely about the kind of the German context and where this obsession with form really starts. And then let's maybe jump close to the end of your story, but not quite to the end, not quite to structuralism, which is sort of the logical conclusion of the formal obsession, but one step before Sapir and Whorf. And one thing that I've noticed, I mean, obviously not for the first time, but it's very clear that the history of modern linguistics is a history of monolingualism, of national languages, and that there really, because of the way it got started, there really is no interest in language contact and in kind of multilingualism and in linguistic diversity. But Sapir and Whorf are actually credited with being interested in linguistic diversity. I mean, that was very important to them, and also drawing on Boas. And so maybe can you tell us a bit about the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, in quotation marks for everyone who can't see us, and how that sort of is close to the end of your story?
Yeah, sure. Can I just quickly say too, on the question or on the topic of 15 chapters? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there are 15 chapters with content that tell the story, mm-hmm. and then two sort of an introduction and a conclusion. But I think saying 15 chapters sort of misrepresents the style of the book, because it makes it sound like it's a gigantic tome. But it's actually a really short book. It's like 200 pages, and mm-hmm. the chapters are really short. It's you know, it's made to be very snappy, and
it is snappy.
Okay, right.
Audience, yeah. So it's really very readable. And
okay, all right.
Beautifully resolved.
Yeah.
Sorry to kind of create an impression of this is being, but I mean, I guess we can't really cover all these developments
in
our conversation.
Yeah.
So let's
On the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, yeah, and linguistic diversity. I mean, this is a very interesting question. I mean, it depends a little bit by what you mean by linguistic diversity, but perhaps, what you're getting at with Sapir and Whorf is this interest, you know, in indigenous languages of America and other parts of the world, so indigenous as opposed to the sort of written standardized languages of, you know, familiar from the European countries, and that is definitely something they're interested in. And the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, as is well known, and you put it in inverted commas because neither Sapir nor Whorf actually formulated a hypothesis, you know, in the sense of something that could be tested, you know, like a definite statement that could be tested.
Can you maybe just tell our audience how the name came about? So
yeah.
Neither of these two men ever claimed that they had formulated a hypothesis, and still that's all we can think of now. I mean, it's one of the most well-known linguistic facts, if you will, outside the academy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first attestation of the term, as far as I'm aware, in print, comes from Harry Hoyer, who had been a student of Sapir's, but from the 1950s. So after both Sapir and Whorf had died, and Hoyer used the term in the context of a conference that he convened on the so-called Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. So on the idea that there's some sort of connection between language and thought, or perhaps even that language influences thought. But so Sapir and Whorf didn't formulate a hypothesis as such, but they definitely wrote lots of things about the interplay of language and thought. Whorf perhaps more so. And I think one of the most, well, there's a few interesting things that can be said about the background to the Sapir, to both Sapir and Whorf's ideas on linguistic relativity, as you could also describe it. So one is that there is a German tradition, which Sapir was directly in touch with, and Boas as well, who was Sapir's, a doctoral supervisor and mentor. And this, you know, this goes back to Humboldt and Herder and so on. And that's also something I talk about in the book. But there's also a contemporary context for Sapir emphasizing linguistic relativity, that, you know, that language creates a worldview and shapes how we see the world, and Whorf too, for that matter. And this contemporary context is that there was a lot of discussion on a political level about propaganda in the period between World War I and World War II. You know, so this is the era in which totalitarianism arose in Central Europe and in Eastern Europe as well. And there was a feeling that, that propaganda often had a linguistic basis, that it was a deliberate abuse of language, you know, to shape the way people think, you know, to sort of brainwash them. And this finds an expression also in the philosophy of the period. So in the sort of, in early analytic philosophy, or in the earliest works that fed into what later became analytic philosophy of people like Bertrand Russell, but even Wittgenstein, you can see this discourse that we need to purify language in order to be able to think clearly and logically. So this is what motivated Russell's logical atomism. And he says this as much in his scholarly writings, but also in his popular writings where he's presenting his ideas. And there was a whole ecosystem of popular books, so like The Meaning of Meaning by Ogden and Richards, which forms the basis, or as one of the major works that I talk about in my first book, Language and Meaning in the Age of Modernism, but also Korzybski with General Semantics, and so on. There's a whole heap of these. So I think that it's fair to say that Sapir, in emphasizing linguistic relativity, was picking up on this discourse. And you can find him also, you can find Sapir also directly referring to this discourse of how language can be abused to brainwash people. I believe that Sapir was picking up on this discourse and using it as a justification for doing linguistic scholarship. You know, Sapir says, by studying diverse languages, so languages that have a very different structure from the familiar European languages, such as the indigenous languages of America, we can get a completely different view on the world, and that we can see how the way that we, you know, what we assume to be a fact is just an illusion created by our language. And this also comes out very clearly in Worf, in Worf's writings. Mm-hmm. And Worf is perhaps more explicit about it too.
Yeah, I was really fascinated by how you describe that. Partly the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis is a form of language critique. And of course, that feeds into another key tension that runs through modern linguistics, the tension between descriptivism and prescriptivism, and whether we just describe language or whether we actually engage with the meanings of language, as we've earlier said. Before we end, I'd like to quickly draw at one other kind of dichotomy or tension that also comes out really nicely in your book, and that is sort of the establishment of linguistics as a scientific discipline and, you know, the ambition to be scientific, but at the same time, the constant undercurrent of all kinds of romantic ideas. So there is the German romanticism, but also the romanticization of ancient India, for instance. So that's a big topic. Or then Worf and his theosophy, yeah, and his kind of spiritual worldview. So can you maybe talk about this tension a bit more between linguistics as a science, but linguistics also as a romantic philosophy or a spiritual undercurrent, the spiritual undercurrents.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So, I mean, this is actually a topic that is much broader than disciplinary linguistics itself. It has to do with, you know, what is considered in this period from the 19th century up to the present, what is considered legitimate scholarship and what, you know, what is considered science. You know, so this, the English word science generally refers only to natural science. You know, we make a clear distinction between the sciences and, you know, the sciences in the sense of the natural sciences and the humanities. And I can't really think if there's a sort of superordinate term that would cover both of those. I don't know, in English, I don't think so. Scholarship? Yeah, I don't know.
Research.
Research, yeah, perhaps. But, you know, in the European context, like Wissenschaft can also be, you know, can be Geisteswissenschaft, you know, or Naturwissenschaft. You know, and the Naturwissenschaften and the Geisteswissenschaften have their own, do they have their own methods and do they have their own objects of study? Or are they both two different manifestations of the same thing? You know, and this is a debate that ran throughout the 19th century and influenced linguistics. So by the end of the century, you know, if we start at the beginning of the century, you know, the Humboldtian University was very much oriented towards the humanities, the Geisteswissenschaften. They were the more important ones. And the natural sciences were considered to be, you know, less prestigious. But as the century wore on, the natural sciences could show all sorts of amazing discoveries, you know, in fundamental physics and chemistry, and all sorts of really interesting and useful applications of these discoveries in the development of technology, you know, so electricity and, you know, new medicines and new chemicals that were synthesized and so on. So the natural sciences grew in prestige during the 19th century. And by the 1880s, this became a bit of a sticking point for the humanities and in linguistics, there was this question of whether linguistics should orient itself towards the natural sciences, or whether it should, you know, claim its own special method as, you know, as one of the humanities. And the neo-grammarians, of course, were very strongly on the natural science end of this debate, you know, with their emphasis on sound laws, saying that these are a kind of natural law. But critics of the neo-grammarians, you know, people like Schuchart, were saying, you know, that doesn't make any sense, that, you know, the sound laws are not like natural laws because, you know, they have limited applicability. They only work in a single language or a single dialect, and they only work for a certain period of time, like they go to completion. So they can't be equated to things like the law of gravity, which applies everywhere in the universe. So someone like Schuchart argued, it's just trying to, you know, grasp at the prestige incorrectly of the natural sciences by importing this into linguistics. I say that this came to a head in the 1880s, but it was already building up through the century. So, I mean, Schleicher, another figure who I talk about in the book, in mid-century was already going down this path, you know, where the debate was more in terms of materialism, as I described in the book, which is more a debate about whether, you know, laws of matter, like laws of physics, tell us everything that we need to know about the world, or whether there's like a special, you know, world of the soul or world of the mind that exists separately from this. Yeah. And this, you know, debate continued after this period. It didn't end in the 19th century, but it's probably fair to say that the model that has won out in linguistics is very much a scientistic model, you know, that wants to orient linguistics as a discipline to a sort of natural scientific conception of the world.
Mm-hmm. One last question, maybe. So for a sociolinguist like myself, I mean, one thing that is very noticeable in your history is that there really was no place in the story of the birth of modern linguistics. There was no place for linguistic diversity. There was no place for language contact. There was no place for multilingualism and all those kinds of things that weren't clearly tied to one language, one nation, if you will. And so can you maybe talk a bit about this history that is not there and how that got back into linguistics again, or how it was written out?
Yeah, well, I think it was written out because of this form fetishism, mm-hmm. of this obsession with the language as the object of study that is an entity in its own right, and that the job of the linguist is to describe its grammar and so on. Because if you make the language into the thing that you're studying, then there's no space for speakers. It's not about people speaking language, it's about this abstract thing that exists independently of them. But even in the 19th century, you know, so I talk about William Dwight Whitney, you know, even William Dwight Whitney in the mid-19th century started to talk about diversity in, you know, in text. So he still had a philological method where he was analyzing written texts, but he looked at the distribution of, you know, of different sounds in the text, and calculated, you know, he produced tables and calculated statistically how sounds were distributed in very, you know, not using the sort of sophisticated statistical methods that we know today, but still like talking in terms of percentages, and using that to describe tendencies in the development of languages. And on a theoretical level, he also talked about the individual speaking subject and how people are interacting with each other in language will influence each other, and how, you know, an individual might innovate a change, but then it has to be ratified by the speech community to become part of the language. And there were other figures as well throughout or into the latter half of the 19th century who talked about the speaking subject and their place in the community of speakers. But it is definitely true that this was a, you know, minority and oppositional position that you could take in studying language, because the default position in linguistics was to talk about the language as an abstract thing. Yeah. And, well, the introduction of modern sociolinguistics, or the advent of modern sociolinguistics, is probably, I think it's fair to say, a phenomenon mostly of the post-World War II era. So it definitely has roots that go back earlier than that, but as a sub-discipline in its own right, it's a post-World War II thing. So you'll have to wait for volume 2 of the book to be able to find out about that.
That's brilliant. So is that what's next for you, James?
Well,
volume 2, post-World War?
If I get funding, yes.
Brilliant. So we are looking forward to that and very much hope that you'll get the funding. So,
yeah.
Thanks again, James. And thank you for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe to our channel, leave a 5-star review on your podcast app of choice, and recommend the Language on the Move podcast and our partner, the New Books Network, to your students, colleagues, and friends. Till next time.